Welcome back to the CBS Sports Podcast. I am pretty thrilled, humbled, and honored to bring on today's guest. You know, it's summer, and we do so much college hoops around here with the pod, but do like to mix it up, and we've got a college basketball flavor, but bringing on Vern Lundquist, who has, you know, a career that has spanned decades and goes so much beyond the hardwood. So, Vern, thank you so much for taking some time out of your day here on a warm July Thursday afternoon. How you doing?
I'm doing fine, Matt. And as you're talking with me, I'm sitting in my office in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, looking up at the mountain, and it's about 65 degrees, so life is good.
Well, actually, you mentioned Colorado, and I want to ask you, have things been okay in terms of the wildfires by you? Were you affected by that at all?
We were not affected. We're on the western slope. We're about 165 miles due northwest of Denver. So most of the fire activity that has been so tragic occurred down in Colorado Springs and Denver and Fort Collins on the Front Range. Now, we are under what they call stage 2 fire alerts, so there are restrictions on any kind of outdoor burning. We had to cancel our fireworks, along with a lot of other towns and cities in Colorado. We're also under water restrictions, which means that you can water only every third day, and various things like that. We're very, very, very dry. And we went through something similar here. Nancy and I have lived here since 1984. And 10 years ago, 2002, we had the same kind of a circumstance and had about 3 fires ultimately in the summer that that burned around the city but never got into it.
Wow, that's some pretty harsh stuff. And
it's a wake-up call, let me tell you. It really is.
Water rationing, yeah, that is that is incredible.
Well, just to complete that, we canceled the fireworks. We have a hot air balloon rodeo here that usually, and it's a highlight of the summer. It features anywhere from 35 to 45 balloons going up early in the morning. That was to have taken place last weekend. That was canceled. We had a cattle drive, but we're a western town, and they had to cancel that because of fear of heat damage to the animals. And then probably most significantly of all, we sit on the banks of the Yampa River, and it's an old Indian name, and it goes from here all the way to Utah, to the Colorado, and there's just a ton of river activity during the summer, kayaking, inner tubing, that sort of thing. That's all been canceled. So we're feeling the effects of it.
Okay, that's brutal. Well, hopefully things turn around soon. You live in some gorgeous country out there. I was actually born in Denver. I only lived until I was about 9 months old. We actually ended up getting out of there. But my uncle lives out in Denver. I was there last year for the first weekend of the tournament. And Colorado is just a gorgeous, gorgeous place. So you certainly
especially in the summer.
Yeah,
it really is
a good place to settle down. All right. Well, you know, I bring you on in part because you've been with CBS for 30 years. So I figure the podcast will just be, you know, nice and conversational about some of the highlights, maybe a low light or two, a good story that you can share. But before we get to how you got at CBS, can you just quickly tell your story of basically how you got into the business and what it was like when you were, you know, 19, 20, 21 years old, thinking about getting into broadcasting? Was it a really competitive market back then? And what were the steps people took then? Because obviously it's a lot different from how a kid that, say, you know, goes to Syracuse or Missouri or whatever today gets into the business today.
Right. It's light years removed. And I'm coming up on Labor Day will be the anniversary of my 49th, that's frightening to say.
That's awesome.
Of my 49th year, that'll be the beginning, when I first stepped in front of a television camera as a sports anchor. That was in Austin in 1963. Mine is, you know, I do a lot of college journalism or broadcasting classes whenever I'm asked. And inevitably the question, well, how do you get where you are? And the avenues are so many as to you could build a galaxy. And we've all got different stories. So mine is not particularly helpful to a young person who wants to get into network television or cable television. Quite simply, I've got a degree in sociology and a minor in history from Texas Lutheran University, a liberal arts college of 1,400 in Seguin, Texas. I worked as a part-time radio disc jockey for my senior year. I then, upon graduation, was a little uncertain. I mean, this was the early 60s. I thought about the Peace Corps, seriously. I thought about law school. I thought about radio television. And in the end, because my dad was a Lutheran minister, I decided to go to theological school. And I was just kind of putting off a decision as to where I wanted to spend the rest of my life professionally. I don't think I ever had any intention of actually, you know, becoming a pastor in a Lutheran church. This was just kind of delaying whatever decision I needed to make. And I'll try and be as succinct as I can. I went to the Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois, the Lutheran School of Theology, and I worked as a disc jockey across the river in Davenport, Iowa, at WOC Radio. When the summer ended, I knew I didn't belong there at the seminary, not the radio station. And I went home to Austin and landed a summer replacement job as an FM disc jockey at the radio television station owned by President and Mrs. Johnson. And during that summer, kind of uneasy about what I wanted to do, the sportscaster for and we were the only television station in town, took a job in Houston. I boldly walked into the program director's office and said, I'd really like to audition for the sports job. And he gave me the audition, and they put me on the air Labor Day. And I decided right then immediately that that's what I really wanted to do. So I was there 3 years. I went to San Antonio for 1 year. The biggest break I got early on was I landed a job at WFAA-TV in Dallas among the newsroom members at that time over a four-year period were Scott Pelley, Lisa Gibbons, Paula Zahn, and most shockingly of all, Bill O'Reilly. We were all in the same newsroom over, so say, 79-83. I did the Cowboy Radio broadcast. You know, you fall into it. And that led to an association with ABC. I did regional college football and some golf for ABC. And then in 82, I was kind of stalled at ABC. I really wasn't going anywhere, and I knew that. And CBS got college football. And a young man named Rick La Civita was hired to head up their college football program, and he was from ABC. And he and I had been friends, and he urged me to take a chance and come over. And that story gets real long, but in the fall of 82, I took the chance, made the leap at Rick's insistence, and now I've been there 30 years, and this evening in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, Nancy and I are having dinner with Rick La Civita. He's in town here for a month.
That's fantastic. Now I got to hit on the FMD.
Now, that doesn't help that doesn't help some poor junior.
I know. That's okay.
Right?
Okay. It's story time with Uncle Vern here. So,
okay.
But I got to ask you about the DJ stuff here. So was it originally you thought maybe you were going to have a career, you know, spinning vinyl? Is that what?
No.
Okay. So that was just kind of biding your time still, while you were kind of flip-flopping between that and your time over in Illinois.
Yeah, I never, ever, ever would have stayed in the business if that's where I was going to destined to wind up. I worked for my first radio station was here's a small world story. My first radio station playing records was KWED Radio 1580 Sun Up to Sundown in Seguin, Texas. They hired one guy a year from the college to do Saturday and Sunday. The guy they hired the year before I got the job has stayed in television and has done fairly well. His name is Don Mischer, and he just co-produced the Oscars.
Really?
Yeah. And Don and I are a year apart. We were co-disc jockeys at KWED and Ray Radio. I would never have stayed in it if that was what I was going to do. That was a way to earn, $2.75 an hour.
Okay.
No, it was, and I was not. I learned early on what many young men, and I guess young women, learn. I loved athletics, but I was not gifted athletically, and it happened for me in high school. I made it as far as the end of the bench of the varsity basketball team my junior year, but I never got in the game. And at the end of the year, the coach said, you know, you might want to go in a different direction. So I did. I wrote for the senior. I wrote for our high school newspaper. I wrote a sports column. I did the same thing in college, a small liberal arts college. I wrote for our weekly newspaper. I wrote a sports column. I did all the public address at the basketball and football and baseball games. But no, I mean, I can still. I've still, this dates me and makes you feel real young. Somewhere in this office, in this home in which I'm speaking, I have a reel-to-reel tape. You don't remember those. But on it, it says, "Hi, I'm Mick, I'm Bob, I'm John. We're the Kingston Trio. Stay tuned to the Vern Lundquist Show from Radio 59, 5 to 9, Monday through Friday."
You are
not everybody in sports broadcasting has one of those.
Well, you're reading my mind here, because legitimately my next question was what is the oldest piece of tape of you that you still own? I wanted to know if you had anything from, you know, the 50s or early 60s.
I have radio tape of stuff. I've actually, when I started doing the Cowboys broadcast, that would be from 63. It's a reel-to-reel piece. I have cassette tapes of almost all, not all, but most of the games that I did as the play-by-play announcer for the Cowboy radio broadcast, beginning in 1972. I've got them stashed in a bunch of cardboard boxes, memorabilia rooms. The first videotape I have, I've got a storeroom back here, and I'm trying to transfer a lot of this stuff to DVD, so to make it digital. I have a tape of a 1975 newscast from Channel 8 in Dallas. I know I've got that. And the first game I've got, game broadcast, would be probably A&M at Arkansas in 78, and that was right when you could start recording at home. You don't remember this, but the old initial videotape recordings were 90-inch reels, 90-minute reels, and they were 2-inch wide.
Jeez.
And so you couldn't store those real easily in your garage.
Yeah, no, things have gotten much easier. All right, how about this? What is the weirdest sports event you've ever covered?
The World Horse Jumping Championship.
Okay, that qualifies.
Yeah, in Aachen, that's Germany. Bob Dekus was the producer. Vinny was the AD on the show. I can't remember, and our expert was Robert Ridlon. This was in 83, 84, 85. This was in Aachen, which is just between Belgium, and I'd never done a horse jumping contest in my life. And I didn't know until we got there that there were stadiums reserved for horse jumping. And this one held 60,000 people, including Queen Anne. And it was a heck of an experience. And I didn't know a thing about it. And so I looked at videotape, and I said to Robert Ridlon before we started, "Pal, it's all on you." And he said, "If you can get the name of the horse and the rider properly pronounced, I'll get us through the rest of it."
Okay, good stuff. Now, you're going to be 72 here in a few days, so in advance of that, happy birthday. It's a damn pleasure to continue to get your calls. I say this legitimately, not to kind of brown nose you. This is a big reason why I wanted to have you on the podcast, because in a way, I think a lot of people would agree with me that when we turn on a certain game and you're calling it, there's a real sense that there's familiarity to it. It's like I get the same feeling with Raftery and Call of Troops. Mm-hmm. Just like, you just know that there's going to be a certain tone to a game, regardless of what happens on the field or on the court, and people like that. So are you thinking that you still have another, you know, 3, 4, 5, maybe even longer in the game here, or is retirement something that might be sneaking up soon in the next couple here?
I'll make a public announcement that Sean McManus won't mind. Okay. I just re-upped for 2 more. And in the re-upping, that will get me to 74. And that's, you know, essentially the load I'm carrying now. Yeah, Matt, of course, you reach a certain age. And my concern is that the quality of my work starts to subside. And, I've been conscious of guys who've stayed too long at the dance. We all have. And I don't want that to happen to me. I don't want, we work in a very public world. And especially now with the advent of the internet and blogs and the like. So you're being scrutinized, if not criticized, constantly. And I have an agreement, to say this publicly, I have an agreement with Craig Silver, my producer for football. And of course, I worked with different guys in basketball and golf. But Craig and I have known each other forever, and the deal is, if he senses that I start to slip, we're going to sit down and have a heart-to-heart. My intention is to go as long as I can and feel comfortable about it. And it just as an aside, here's where the company, CBS, has been so great for me. We live in northwestern Colorado. I work in the college season in the Southeast Conference. That's a 9.5-hour commute on Thursdays to get down there, and it's a 9.5-hour commute on Sundays to get home. I don't see many NFL games. I'm in a small plane getting home. 2 years ago, Sean McManus took me aside and said, "Let's talk. Would you and Nancy be willing to relocate to Atlanta during the SEC so that we can reduce the stress of travel?" And I said, absolutely we would. So coming up now, this will be the 3rd year we've done it. We'll go down to Atlanta in a corporate apartment. It's very nice. It's nothing lavish. But it reduces our travel time. So what is a 9.5-day traveling becomes an hour and a half out of Atlanta's airport or a drive. And in the last 2 years, I can't tell you how much stress that's relieved. So the company has been very kind in wanting to make it the easiest it can be for me to do this. And I, in turn, I still enjoy the preparation. I love the games. I love working with Gary. I love working with Clark Kellogg, Bill Raftery, obviously, all the golf guys. So it's only the getting to and getting home that I find trouble.
Right. Well, travel. Travel is so troublesome absolutely. Travel, getting on a plane, it can just absolutely just kill a day. I think, you mentioned the internet and blogs and how people can be so reactionary. I mean, there's a site I go to frequently called awfulannouncing.com. They do a terrific job in kind of just documenting, because actually, people have always said, people watch games no matter who the announcers are, and I agree with that, but I also think fans just get to know announcers as well as they get to know athletes, because so many of you stay around for 10, 20, 30 years, and so it's just part of the experience of watching games. But in my opinion and from my perspective, you've actually been one of the few who has largely, if not entirely, dodged criticism, rightfully so. And you've got this youthfulness about you, Vern, that I think is just so infectious. I mean, it's just so jovial. And it comes so natural. It's happened even a couple times on the podcast already. I mean, how how are you able to keep that? I mean, you don't seem to have any sort of cynicism about you, and it really makes what you do and listening to it all the more enjoyable and sort of natural. So how have you been able to keep that tenor about your work consistent and not in any sort of way forced or fabricated over the decades?
Boy, that's a challenging question. I appreciate your comments very much, but I don't know that I can answer it without sounding like a narcissist.
please get self-indulgent.
It's a style, Matt. I began, you know, when I first started doing play-by-play. And by the way, my aspiration when I got into television in 1963, my aspiration was to do exactly what I'm doing now. I never wanted to be a studio guy. I always wanted to be my role model. I've told millions of people this, was Jim McKay, because Jim McKay was one of the best writers we've ever had. He also had this unique ability, or maybe not unique, maybe it's shared, of making you feel when he was at an event for 90 minutes on Saturday afternoon at Wide World of Sports. He made me feel, at least, and I think millions of others feel, as if there's no better place you can spend your time than enjoying this with me, and I'll kind of be your guide through this. So to whatever subconscious level I've adopted that style, I think that's where it maybe came from. I also don't think I take myself quite as seriously as some of my colleagues. And I've always believed this, and this has been a conversation of that includes some disagreements among producers over the years. I've always felt that my job was to be the setup guy, okay? That I can't sit next to Gary Danielson and pretend to have one-tenth of the knowledge mm-hmm. of dissecting a football game that he can. I can't sit next to Billy Packer or Dan Fouts or Terry Bradshaw. That's not my role. I'm not there to give my opinions about why they should do this. I've always thought of myself as much more of a storyteller. And so I don't know that that's an answer to a very complimentary question. I'll give you an anecdote, though, about, you know, I live in a world of college kids. I'd love to share this one with you. I live in a world of college athletics. And so I'm dealing with 18 to 22-year-olds mostly. And it's a challenge at 72 to remain relevant to those students and the athletes themselves. Here's one of the absolutely unforeseen benefits I got out of doing a movie 15 years ago. Okay? I played myself in this silly movie starring Adam Sandler called Happy Gilmore. The movie has become, it's shown once a month on USA cable, and it's such a favorite of the college kids. And I get taunts and questions about that every week.
Wow.
So, and there's one line that I have in the movie when they introduce Happy Gilmore, Adam Sandler, to the PGA Tour for the first time. And on the first tee, here is Happy Gilmore. And I turn to the guy next to me and put my hand up and say, "Who the hell is Happy Gilmore?" Yeah. Well, it gets a laugh every time. So now, go back May 14th, 2 months ago. For the first time in my life, I'm giving a commencement address, and it's at Hampden-Sydney College, this wonderful, beautiful men's liberal arts college, 1,400 students, 60 miles from Richmond. And I really worked hard on it. I mean, I spent a lot of time preparing my remarks. So I get up, and we've been, you know, I'm wearing the hood, and everybody is, and the graduates are all sitting in the middle. And Dr. Chris Howard, the president, introduces me, and I've got my prepared notes. I mean, there's not going to be anything ad lib about this. And as I started to open my mouth, one of the graduating seniors stood up in the middle of the class and said, "Hey, Burn, who the hell is Happy Gilmore?" Well, I said, I can tell right now that the high level of discourse I expected here has probably been lowered a bit. And it, the connection with the college kids helps.
Yeah, and I say this in a complimentary way, but you've got the embraceable grandfather feel to it. It's just kind of like when we watch the games, it's just, I don't know, you kind of set up the scene, and it's in a way where it's like, this is great, let's just not take ourselves too seriously because this is sports we're dealing with after all.
Yeah.
A few things here. One, the most famous game you've been associated with is, I guess, the Leitner shot over Duke, but the question I have is, what game did you call before the outcome? Like, after the Duke-Kentucky game, you're like, wow, I can't believe that. I obviously feel so privileged to have called that. But
right.
You didn't know what Duke-Kentucky would be before you called it, so I don't suspect that it's going to be the answer to this question. What game, as you had your prep work, you set your papers in front of you, you put the headphones on, you got ready to go on the air, what game above any other did you feel like, damn, I can't believe I'm calling this. I feel so privileged. You know, what was the biggest deal before you actually called it in the history of your career?
I've got one. It would be when Tebow was a sophomore, and we did a primetime game at Florida at LSU. And I think that's the best college football game I've ever seen. That was 28-24. It's when Les Miles at Tiger Stadium went for fourth down five times and was successful five times, and they won it. They came from behind and won it. We thought that was going to be a good game, and it lived up to its billing. We had number one versus number two, Alabama LSU in prime time last year, and people thought because of 9-6 win that it wasn't satisfactory. It was a pretty good game, but I would pick. I would say Florida LSU when Tebow was a sophomore is still probably my favorite college game. Now I did. My wife and I just talked about this last night. None of us knew this was going to be a classic, but I did the Missouri-Kansas basketball game last year. The last in 100 and whatever.
Did you really? I was at UConn that night, so I did not realize that you called that. Okay, cool.
Oh my gosh, it was. That's one of the great games I've ever seen, and more because of the setting, Matt. I mean,
yeah.
Allen Fieldhouse. If I had to pick my favorite college basketball arena, that would probably be it. And then you know, for Missouri to go out on top and Kansas to come back and win, and then if you go way back, I mean, I did radio broadcasts of five Super Bowls with the Cowboys.
Yeah.
That was not television, but I thought Super Bowl 13 was going to be a classic, and it turned out it was. That's Pittsburgh won that. That's when Jackie Smith dropped the pass in the end zone.
Well, that is actually, I mean, that might be your most famous call. That's when you said, "Bless his heart, he's got to be the sickest man in America." In regard to your famous calls, I mean, even the Leitner shot, when you just exclaim yes, when these big moments come, are they for the most part natural? Do they just come out of you? And it's almost like I think Nance once said. I think Nance has said that when Hayward missed the shot for Butler against Duke, he doesn't even remember what he said like 2 minutes later. With you, with Jackie Smith, with Leitner beating Kentucky, with some of Tiger's big putts, you know, if they happen in a moment and I went up to you 5 minutes later, would you have remembered what you said? How can you kind of explain those big moments and why big calls become memorable calls?
Well, I think it's hard to explain. I actually, you know, and I have been blessed because I have been present when significant events broke out in front of me. And so the challenge then is to equal with your voice inflection and your language to equal the accomplishment of the athletes in front of you. And to do it in as much of a minimalist way as you can, to inject whatever vocal contribution you have to make, but then to get out of the way. And in my case, the ones that people seem to remember are very simple. I do get asked this a lot. You know, I've had two that are people around Augusta are going to remember forever because it involved Jack Nicklaus,
yep,
and it involved Tiger Woods. I say this without any kind of hesitancy at all. People are going to remember the chip shot at Tiger Woods at 16 and 05 when after the ball went in. And I don't know where this came from. I was just reacting as a fan, and I said, in your life, have you ever seen anything like this? Well, I had a guy call me a couple of weeks after that and ask me if I had scripted that. And I was incredulous. And I said, do you mean, did I have it written down? He said, yeah. And I said, well, think about what you're asking. On Saturday night when I couldn't sleep, did I envision a scenario in which Tiger Woods would be 180 feet from the hole, he would do a 90-degree right-hand turn, it'd go 90 feet, it would sit on the edge of the cup for 1.8 seconds, showing the Nike logo to the world, it would drop in, and he'd birdie the hole. And I scripted what I was going to say. No, you just react. And in all of them, I mean, I had a guy from Atlanta once ask me if I was really, really proud of the call on the Leitner shot. And I said, no, not particularly, because when I heard it played back, I realized I was channeling my inner Marv Albert. You know, I mean, Marv made yes,
yeah,
synonymous with a call. Said no. And my favorite call, and everybody brings up Al Michaels at the 1980 Olympics. And it was a great call. Do you believe in miracles? Yes. And then he follows that up in the championship game, the gold medal game, by saying this impossible dream has come true. Those are two of the best calls in the history of sports broadcasting. But my two favorite of all came from the same game with two of the giants of our business, one doing television, one doing radio. It was the Dodgers and Oakland game one of the World Series, the famous home run by Kirk Gibson. Over the right field fence. And Vin Scully, who just, you know, I don't think there's anybody that's ever come close to him, ever, in terms of quality of a professional career. And this had been a troubling year for the Dodgers. So he says whatever he says, Gibson hits it out of the park, and then he goes circle, and Scully does what Michaels does so well, and what I hope I do well, just get out of the way. And he let, now think about this. He let Gibson circle second, third, home plate, go into the dugout, come out, get a standing ovation, go back into the dugout. He still hasn't said a word. He comes back out for the second time, and then only when Gibson disappears into the dugout and the applause begins to subside does Scully say, in a year of the improbable, the impossible has happened. That's my greatest line I think I've ever heard for sports. But simultaneously, here's Jack Buck on radio. Just the complete opposite. The ball goes over the fence, and Jack Buck, whom I loved dearly when he was alive, said, I don't believe what my eyes just saw.
Yeah, those are
two, pretty good.
Yeah, they are. And I've always looked at Scully the same way I look at Bob Dylan. It's like these absolute massive giants of their industry, and we should feel like pretty damn lucky that they're still not only alive but active in what they do. It's like, I can't.
How about that? He's still working at 85.
It's unbelievable.
It truly is, and I don't know him well, Matt, but I've been around him a little, you know, and I knew Jack Buck much more intimately than I know Vin, but I did have an occasion to tell Vin Scully once that with all due respect to Al Michaels, and do you believe in miracles, that his call, because it had an element of poetry to it, I thought, and I said to him, where did you come up with that? And he laughed and said, I don't know, but it was pretty good, wasn't it?
All right, let's go out on this here. You have exceeded my already lofty expectations here, and I appreciate, again, you taking so much time. We're going to have to do a follow-up podcast because we haven't even touched on, geez, I've got like 20 questions we haven't even addressed here. But I do want to touch on the Penn State stuff here, Vern, because, you know, primarily now, I mean, you still do golf. You still do college basketball, but I think college football is what you have your strongest attachment to here because of the great work you do with the SEC. Now, obviously, Penn State and Joe Paterno are Big Ten schools, but you're obviously very well-versed in the sport in general. I just wanted your perspective on how the legacy of Paterno has been just completely torn down in less than a year. Obviously, we're recording this hours after the free report came out, and anyone listening to this has no doubt heard the news that just basically, you know, Paterno and Graham Spanier and Curley and Schultz were all basically part of a huge cover-up, and more details were released, and it really just doesn't put Paterno in a good light here. I just would love your impressions of what's happened. I mean, obviously, it's a terrible thing, and you have the perspective of basically getting into the business just as Paterno basically got into college football. So, I don't know. To me, it's shocking, and I guess the next decade will really tell how he is ultimately seen. But what are your impressions from this whole Penn State scandal and what seemingly just, I don't know, the worms seem to spill out more and more by the week here, and maybe we've seen the worst of it, but what's your assessment, Vern?
Well, as I told you, I have not read the reports yet, but one of my best friends was my colleague for 6 years, Todd Blackledge. We worked from 2000 to 2005 at CBS. And we stay in touch. He spoke at Joe's funeral. We talked that night. He was on the board of the Second Mile, Sandusky's Foundation. And just to absolve, in this case, one of the great players at not absolve. He doesn't need my absolution, but just to give you some feeling of where the guys were when this news first broke. Todd said, you know, I played there. I led him to a national championship. I've known Sandusky all my life. I never had a clue. He said, I was on the board of the Second Mile while some of these molestations were alleged to have occurred. And he is heartbroken. And his love for Joe, he went up to see Paterno. Oh, gosh, he lives in Akron. And he went up to see Joe and Sue, I don't know, maybe a month after long before the trial, but he said he didn't think that Paterno would live long, that he was that crushed by it. Now, having said that, this is one of the great tragedies in college athletics in my 72 years on this earth, and I think that it is going to leave a permanent stain on Joe Paterno's legacy. The more we read and the more we know, now we understand because of the free report that he was aware of the 1998 allegations. And again, without reading it, it just strikes me that there was a huge cover-up and that Spanier, the president, Curley, Schultz, all of them were complicit in deciding not to do anything. That's the lingering impression I have until I read or hear something to oppose that view. I think this is going to stain Penn State as a university for at least a generation.
Yeah, I mean, in 15 years, Vern, do you think Penn State is, as a football program, which, you know, in a lot of ways is just so damn secondary to the things we're talking about. But,
of course.
But in 15 years, is Penn State, you know, is it going to be a complete shell of itself as a football program? Or do you anticipate that that maybe this kind of lingers for a couple of years, but ultimately, you know, it's a crass way.
Well, Matt, my take on that is it's going to linger for a long time because of the lawsuits that are going to be filed.
Yeah,
and it's not going to go away. I mean, I can only imagine. You know, somebody said to me the other day, and I was in Dallas when the SMU program was completely out of control. When a man who became the governor of the state of Texas, Bill Clements, said, Boys, we've got a payroll to meet here. You know, I mean, honest to God.
And until Penn State, SMU was, you know, ironically calling it the gold standard of the worst kind of scandal we've ever seen in college football.
Yes, but think about the difference, though. They were openly paying players.
Yeah.
And here, there was a member of the staff who was destroying lives. So, in my view, there is a distinction to be drawn. I don't know. You don't give Penn State – no. I don't. First of all, I don't think anybody will ever get the death penalty again because of what it cost SMU. You know, now they've gotten back. They're playing in minor bowl games, and June Jones has done a good job down there. But to me, the circumstances of what went on at SMU and what has demonstrably occurred at Penn State are just life-alteringly different.
Yeah.
Because here we had young men's lives destroyed, and people knew it was going on. I guess from not, and I say that not having read the free report, but certainly the headlines and a brief scanning of the story would lead me to believe that the conclusion is that there were a lot of people who were complicit in covering this up, who should not be absolved of their responsibility for it.
Vern Lundquist, ladies and gentlemen. Vern, thank you so much for coming on. And going forward, maybe next summer, would love to reconvene and talk again. By the way, what is your work schedule like? I mean, basically, do you have any more golf?
Well, I'm off.
Till football?
My contractual year with CBS, and we've done this for 10 years. I'm theirs, body and soul, of course. August 1st to April 30th. And so I go back to work here in a month, and I do the PGA. And then just a little promo, we're going to open our college season in Dublin, Ireland, with Notre Dame Navy live.
That's right.
At 9 o'clock in the morning in the east. Mike Oresco, our senior VP, just a half an hour ago sent me an email that included a photograph of the stadium. It's beautiful and sold out, the game is. And then we do the SEC. I go right to college basketball, and I wind up my two anchors, Matt, for the year. And as I said, it's been this way for a decade. I begin the season with the PGA, and I end it with the Masters. So I don't get a lot of sympathy from a lot of folks. There's not heavy lifting involved.
Yeah, it's quite a gig, Vern. Thank you again so much for coming on the podcast. Look forward to another fantastic season of you calling the games. And if we cross paths at a hoops game upcoming here, I'll make sure I try and steal a minute or two from you before the action starts. I'd love to introduce myself. All right?
Please do that. Please do that. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And thank you for listening. We will be back in about 2 weeks. I've got to go to Georgia and then Vegas for some college basketball recruiting stuff. We'll do a wrap-up podcast with Jeff Goodman, Gary Parrish, Jeff Borzello. So look for that, and we'll talk to you soon.